This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Folks, Dr. Joe Cantor joins us, Assistant State Health Officer, for our weekly coronavirus update, and we appreciate the time that he has spent with us for so many weeks in providing what I think is incredible and valuable information each and every time. Dr. Cantor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. It's good to be back with you.
Doc, first time in a long time we've got below the 1,000 patient mark that's hospitalized. What does that mean for us?
It's a good marker. And I was just speaking with some other colleagues in the hospital the other day. Not that long ago, really, only a few, 4 or 5 weeks ago, we were, you know, literally had patients just completely filling the hospitals here. And it's pretty remarkable to see where we're at now. The number of patients with COVID hospitalized in the New Orleans area has come down pretty steadily since April 7th, so over a month. We had over 1,000 just in the New Orleans region then, and we're down now. Yesterday's numbers, if I recall, was about 250. Even more remarkable is the number of patients that we had on ventilators. We had at our peak somewhere in the mid 200s, 250, 260, something like that, just ventilated patients in the New Orleans area, and we're down to below 20 now, which is just remarkable. So we've come a long way, and you know, we certainly hope that we don't backtrack on that.
Absolutely. There's another study out that's talking about a number of physicians are saying it's something that they have never seen before, the manner in which the COVID-19 virus actually hijacks cells. And it's interesting, as they say, that this the virus's ability to make millions of copies of itself if these, interferons invade them. Are you aware of this study and the findings?
You know, not aware of that particular study, but in general, one of the complicating factors in treating for COVID patients is about a week or so into their symptoms, some subset of patients get this inflammatory storm. A bunch of cytokines get produced, interferons ramp up, and the body just goes into overdrive and goes haywire. And the thought is that it's in part because the virus is attacking cells, and then it's also because the body's defenses overreact to that, and both of those two processes are damaging. Initially, earlier on, you know, in this outbreak, there was the hope that maybe steroids could help tamp down on that. One of the things steroids do is they decrease the body's, you know, immune reaction. So they maybe could have helped, but the early studies didn't show any benefit from using steroids. So there still isn't a great way to treat this, but you know, clinicians will tell you they'll have patients on a regular hospital floor, not ICU, for about a week, 8 or 9 days, something like that, doing okay, kind of plateauing with COVID. And then at that 8-9 day mark, a small subset of them just tank and take a turn for the worse. And the challenge is we don't really know how to predict that. We haven't figured out yet which patients are going to do that.
Yeah, they were saying, and I guess there's a downside to injecting more interferons into the body. They were looking into lung cells and found that there were no interferons there. And And they were saying that if there's nothing to stop the virus from replicating and festering in the lungs forever. And what I found interesting in the article is that these virologists had said they've never seen this before, which is, you know, kind of another curveball thrown by COVID-19.
Yeah, add it to the list, you know. This Kawasaki's-like illness that we're seeing in some kids now, you know, it's not that uncommon to see strange things with viruses. You can get a strange rash. Some people can get strange post-inflammatory syndromes, even episodic paralysis. But it seems like it's in higher numbers now. So I think you're right. There's just a lot that we don't yet understand. And the hope is that there are some effective treatments that are out there that we also haven't put our finger on yet, but will hopefully soon.
Yeah. There's a new article out, Doc, talking about these super spreader events, and that a group of research folks have gone back to trace things that went on in Italy, South Korea, China, and others, and they in Germany as well. And these super spreader events really are more about contact. Close contact than it is about numbers, because there was one party at less than 100 people in Germany in a community that actually developed a hot spot. It was a dance. It was a social dance. I think 70 to 90 people attended, and the next thing they knew, 14 days later, the disease had run amok throughout this entire community. When we think about those events in particular in relation to tracing, do you think we can get to the point in time in the U.S. that we're going to have enough tracing capacity to be able to beat back this so that we could get to this point of having these types of events?
Yeah, I do, at least somewhat significantly. You know, part of the hope with contact tracing is that you let people who were exposed and may now be asymptomatically infected, you let them know that they're at risk of spreading and that they have to stay home. You know, at this point in the outbreak, I think it's relatively safe to say that if folks are sick, they're going to stay home and not put anyone else at risk. The big challenge now is that you can be asymptomatic and spread these things. And that's really where the contact tracing comes in, because you would otherwise have no idea that you were directly linked to a confirmed case. And, you know, I mentioned we've had our share of super spreader events in the U.S. as well. It's not just Europe. And to the CDC's credit, they've done a good job of highlighting these when they become aware of them and sharing them so that folks can learn from them. A couple that stand out in my mind that I've read, a significant part of Chicago's outbreak, and Chicago is going through a horrible outbreak right now, a significant part of their outbreak was kind of launched, so to say, by a funeral with a family, and then that family had a dinner after the funeral, and they traced back like 20-odd cases to that and a few deaths. And then I believe it was north of Seattle, but there was a choir, a church choir, and somebody in that choir was positive, and just through the vocal expression and the close contact spread to something like 30 other people, and they had a couple of deaths in that too. One of the things that happens in these super spreader events is you have a confluence of unfortunate circumstances. So you have people in close proximity doing a high-risk activity like close contact with a funeral or singing, which we know now can be risky. But you also have the infectious individual at the peak of their viremia. So, you know, the level of virus goes up and then down in your body, and you're most infectious when it's at the peak. And so you just kind of add those two together, and by luck, you end up with these super spreader events.
Well, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. I want to spend a little time talking about how broad does the tracing activity need to be to actually be meaningful and measurable, and because we're getting a number of questions on the text line throughout the week about this as more and more of us are talking about it. We'll be back with Dr. Joe Cantor in just a moment. Stay with us. The Assistant State Health Officer joins us every week for our coronavirus update. This is Newell on WWL. The word is that contact tracing is essential to shutting down the epidemic and having an economy that works, according to Microsoft's CEO. And it begins to take on a new context in the conversation across this country as the economy begins to reopen. We're talking to Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer. Doc, how broad does this actually have to be in order to really be effective as it relates? And I know the state is going about trying to hire, I believe it's 700 contact tracers. If I'm reading the data correctly, we're doing about 8,000 tests a day are being reported. Would that be fair? About 8,000 to 9,000?
That sounds about right, yeah. We typically, in the New Orleans region, do somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 tests a day. Has it been average for us here?
So how broad does this have to be, this program, this strategy in contact tracing?
You know, it's actually difficult to predict because, we're predicting the number of positives that we're going to have that need to be reached, but it's challenging to know how many contacts those positives are going to report. And as opening happens, you know, as we're in phase one and then phase two, the number of contacts people have go up because they're staying at home less. So we think it has to be as broad as necessary to make timely contact with cases under contacts. For ourselves internally, we're shooting for a goal of reaching by phone every new case within 24 hours of us getting that lab, and then building their list of contacts, and then reaching 75% of those contacts within 48 hours, which we feel is a pretty ambitious goal. But you're right. The goal here is to let somebody know that they were exposed in time for them to go back home before they would become viremic and infectious, which on average happens about 4 to 5 days before after somebody gets exposed, if they are going to actually contract the virus. So we think that we're on track for that. I don't know if we're going to end up needing all 700. We're going to ramp this up as the volume demands. But the governor's been pretty clear. I mean, the 700 is just kind of a number based on some projections, but we're going to hire as little or as many as we need to meet those measures.
Right. I saw an article the other day. They were comparing one area of the country to South Korea, and so I went to kind of look to see what South Korea was doing, because their tracing initiative seemed to be very, very successful. But right off the bat, I found something that I think probably is responsible for their success more than anything else, is they have a mandatory quarantine, which I don't guess we're ever going to get to in this country. So as they're going down the path, and they actually compel whoever is in that trace to have a test taken, and if they're positive, they go into a 14-day quarantine as well. So I can understand how that would be very successful in that context in South Korea, but I'm just having a little bit more of a difficulty here in understanding how it's going to really be effective when, once again, the uncertainty of human conduct just completely bastardize any projection that we could ultimately have.
Yeah, South Korea, which is not, I mean, they're not China, they're not an authoritarian regime, but they still kind of go farther in terms of, encroaching on personal liberties and privacy than I think folks in this country would be comfortable doing. But they set up some very large quarantine camps. And when someone needs to quarantine, they send them to these kind of camp-type places, and they spend 2 weeks there. And what we've done here is, we've made that resource available. So we have an isolation camp out in Bayou Signet for anyone that doesn't feel that they have a housing situation that would allow them to isolate safely away from their family. And we make that resource available to anyone that wants it, but we're certainly right. not forcing anyone to do it. But you're right. And, you know, you and I have talked about personal responsibility before. This is part of that. You know, I think there's just going to be a large measure of people in the community having to do the right and responsible thing if we're going to expect to come out of the other side of this anytime soon.
Yeah. I just, and it's not that I'm trying to be critical of it. I'm just trying to set a table or a landscape of reasonable expectations, because I keep hearing the words, but I don't really see how folks are weaving it in operationally that it's going to yield anywhere near results of some of these other countries, because they're doing vastly different things than as you just pointed out, that I doubt very seriously most of the citizens here are going to subject themselves to.
I agree. You know, and I mean, you can take it a step further and you can look at how China was able to turn their outbreak around so quickly. We give China a lot of flack, but they did respond quickly and responded with a much heavier hand than I think we would be able to do here. I mean, they locked down an area of 50 million people. So, you know, I think, you know, we enjoy more liberties here, but, you know, part of the social contract is with those liberties come responsibility, and there's just going to be a lot that's riding on our neighbor's shoulders here to do the right thing.
One of the things that was a little controversial that the mayor put in her plan was this keeping of a log of visitors to restaurants as it relates to as a tool to help facilitate tracing. When we look at the relatively low numbers of folks that are actually going to be logged that way, I mean, is that really an effective tool or measure? Is it almost statistically insignificant?
You know, I don't know, to be honest with you. I think, you know, it's almost like an experiment, and we'll see. There's not a great playbook for this. I think the mayor was, you know, looking at the risk that New Orleans has and how hard New Orleans was hit early on with this, and is looking for any opportunity to do as much. You know, she wants to feel like she's doing as much as she can, and I certainly understand and respect that. You know, whether this only, you know, if it only helps a few people and everyone does it, I mean, that's fine. You know, I think we'll find out, and I'll tell you, as we continue with the contact tracing that'll happen, it'll be obvious to us how much of a help these type of you know, restaurant and business logs are, and if they end up not being useful, then, you know, we'll let folks know that as well.
Yeah, and the only reason I ask, because once again the messaging is that she says, you know, these measures that we've taken, we are the safest city to visit and live, and that's the message that we're trying to send. I pretty much assumed that your answer would be what it is. We don't know. And we've yet to test it, because we've really, in a very limited way, have ever used tracing before. And it's been more of a centralized, localized outbreaks that it's been effective, as opposed to across the whole country. Because if we're doing it in New Orleans, but we're not doing it in St. Bernard, St. Tammany, Jefferson, and Plaquemines that have coterminous boundaries to the parish of Orleans, it seems to me that whatever practices are deployed are going to be significantly watered down.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it goes for a lot of restrictions. You know, Harris is closed, but Treasure Chest is now open. It's not that far of a drive. People might work there, live in Orleans. You know, this is really a regional thing. And I think most of the elected officials understand that. But there's also a lot of variability from state to state, and government.
Yeah, even more. That's even more highlighted. I mean,
yeah, and it kind of encouraged that. And it's not, you know, on one hand, you know, I think I would like a more cohesive national program. But on the other hand, it's not like there's a lot of tried and true playbooks here. So there probably is some room for people to try things that they think make sense for their own jurisdictions. And then I hope we could just communicate and see what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and I ask this, you know, just really more of an educational purposes of the listening audience, because now the CDC is their new stuff that comes out as it relates to surface transmission that very, very difficult. I mean, at first we thought it was a much easier move from point A to point B. Now, not nearly as much, according to what they're saying now. When you take the example that you just said about casinos, if we have a percentage of the population that's going to engage in casino gaming, actually, for purposes of social distancing, opening more or all would probably be better than just opening one in a region, because then you would be compelled and have more people and would probably reach their capacity, which you probably wouldn't reach if you had 10 that were open. I kind of believe that that's a reasonable way of looking at it. And so when we're looking at these measures as though one little bitty piece of geography is a lot more restrictive than the others, and equating that to being better, in my view, I think that's a bridge too far.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, I actually I kind of think along the same lines, stores that have the potential to have crowded situations inside. So a grocery store, for example, I would love to see a grocery store extend their hours, you know, into the night, because that way the people that want to shop can spread it out temporarily and maybe go, you know, I would make groceries at midnight if it meant that the store was a lot less crowded.
I made that same argument in a conversation just the other day. Restricted hours, I think some jurisdictions across this country have actually taken that as a remedial measure. And I said, I think that's contrary to what we're trying to do. You know, those that are at high risk may want to go at 1 o'clock in the morning when nobody's there.
I think so. And you know, the city of New Orleans is going to be flexible with sidewalk space for tables, which is great. Let restaurants put some tables out on the street, make it more spread out. You know, do what you can to space it out, whether that's with more area or, like we just talked about, with the time at which people can go there. I think those are some creative things that people can do.
You know, I want to spend a little time going back to the super spreader events and kind of what the genesis here was. I think a lot of folks, and appropriately so, have pointed to Mardi Gras. And one of the follow-ups that I had to the research that I was doing on these other super spreader events in Europe was they said that not only the virulence, but the acuity seems to have been impacted by prolonged exposure to, you know, if you're sitting next to somebody that's actually infected and you're jumping up and down, you're at a soccer game, you're screaming, you're yelling, you're singing, you know, they tend to put their arms around one another and rock back and forth and everything else, that actually, you know, was a contributor to the acuity level of these patients as well, because of the consistent and persistent exposure that they had over a 3, 4, 5 hour period of time. Your thoughts?
Yeah, we think that's right. And I think about this choir event that the CDC reported on. I think they reported on 1 or 2 weeks ago. But you can imagine somebody who is sick, you know, symptomatic, infectious, in the choir, just singing, you know, vocalizing at the top of their lungs for an hour into the room, and just the amount of respiratory droplets that get projected out there. It is a matter of volume. And, you know, like one tiny virus particle might not infect you, a billion probably will. And where that line gets drawn in the middle is a question I don't think we know the answer to. But when we think about what constitutes a close contact, we think about both how far they are from you, and you know, we typically say 6 feet, even though that's not hard and fast. But we also talk about time. We say 6 feet and within, you know, more than 10 or 15 minutes or so. So both of those things combined to how much viral exposure we think someone's going to get. And when you think about just being in everyday life, you know, passing somebody on the street or jogging past someone, that's not a big risk. But jogging with someone for an hour on the track when you're really close to them probably is a risk. So you got to factor both in the distance and the time.
Do you see anything else out there in the near horizon that causes you concern?
You know, the thing that's keeping me up at night right now is people feeling like because the governor has said that we're in phase one, that that's licensed to kind of go back to the way life was. And, you know, go hang out outside bars, congregate really closely. You know, it's really not. I mean, going into phase one, it really is, it's just as much a reality of, you know, the real need to let businesses open and to let people go back to work. But that needs to be balanced against the undeniable risk that remains out there. You know, by calculation, we have about 9,000 active COVID patients in the state. That still we think are infectious, you know, by our calculations. That's a lot. So just because we're making progress, you know, we're better than we were, people still need to be vigilant, or else, you know, I really do fear that we're going to have to backtrack.
There was a term that you used about the transmission rate. Was it the R something?
R not.
Thank you.
And, yeah.
So where are we right now with the most recent calculations as to the R not? And if you would explain that for the listening audience.
Yeah, definitely. This is some deep epidemiology, you know, for all the budding scholars out there. So,
but it's an important factor, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. We think it is for sure. R-naught is a measure of how infectious a outbreak is at any point in time. So it's the number of people on average that one person who is sick and infectious will spread that virus to. And so, for example, if I am sick and I only spread that virus to one person, I spread it to my wife, then that's an R naught of one. If I spread it to two people, if I spread it to my wife and my daughter, that's an R naught of two. And this gets averaged over a population. So if you have an R naught that is high, you're going to be spreading it exponentially. If you have an R naught that's less than one, you're actually going to be slowly decreasing, because it means, you know, day by day you're going to have less cases than the day prior to that. That's what we're shooting for. So when we were kind of in the real throes of this in the New Orleans area, we were seeing an R naught up to three or four, which is really, really scary, because it means I spread it to four people, those four people each spread it to four additional people, and you can see how it just gets out of control quickly. For the New Orleans area, we're currently tracking at an R naught of 0.8, which is good. It means that on average, one person spreads that virus to less than one additional people, which means that slowly, slowly, we have less and less cases of COVID in the community. Now, this is encouraging. I should say that we got there through very aggressive social distancing, and we're going to be keeping a close eye on that as we reopen. If that R naught goes up to one or greater than one, that's going to be a sign that we've turned a wrong corner and we're going to have to slow back down.
Is it safe to say that we are awaiting that? I mean, you know, as the social distancing measures obviously are relaxed, we enter into phase one. It would seem to me that I wouldn't be surprised if that number went up.
Not going to be surprised. I don't know if I would bet on it. You know, we're certainly prepared. And we feel like we have increased testing capacity pretty significantly, so that if spread does increase, we're going to have visibility on that, because we'll see more cases coming in. And we feel like we have a lot of hospital capacity. You know, we brought in a lot of ventilators. We set up the field hospital and the convention center. So, you know, I think we're ready to both know if that happens quickly and to deal with it. And, you know, fingers crossed, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. There are a lot of controversy over President Donald Trump taking hydroxychloroquine. Do we know what the most recent science is on that drug?
Yeah, the most recent science is that it's more likely to cause harm than it is to give protection. Statistically, if you take it, you're more likely to suffer an adverse cardiovascular event. It gives you arrhythmias than you are to actually prevent exacerbation of COVID. And that's even for people that have COVID. There's even less data on preventing COVID in the first place, which is what I assume the reason that he's taking it for. So, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me in my limited research, it doesn't have much of a prophylactic efficacy out there at all.
We don't think it does. At least it certainly hasn't been shown to. And when you have any intervention that has a known side effect, you know, and this time we're talking about arrhythmias, which are potentially fatal, you got to weigh that known downside against a known upside. And at this point, there really isn't a good known upside. So you're just left with the downside, which is not a good place to be.
I was kind of curious, if you're being tested literally every day, what would compel you to, as a physician, to advise someone to take hydroxychloroquine?
You know, that's a great question. it's not a good call. I mean, I read some theories out there.
I guess I'm thinking in weird ways, Doc. I don't know, but I just, you know, you're being tested every day. I mean, so what would compel you to try to take a prophylactic drug?
I mean. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it, and most of my colleagues would not either.
Yeah. All righty. We've got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer, Coronavirus Update. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer. Doc, a group of 600 doctors recently wrote a letter to President Donald Trump asking him to end these nationwide lockdowns. When we talk about the economy coming back and maybe having a W effect as opposed to a V or a U or a swoosh, they say that there are exponentially growing health consequences with lockdowns in hospitals and so forth without being able to treat non-COVID ailments. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think part of that's right. There are real consequences to deferring. There's obviously consequences to deferring emergency care, and we have reason to believe that there's some people who are suffering strokes and heart attacks at home now in this region and not coming in. But there's certainly also consequences to deferring maintenance routine care. You think about what happened after Katrina. You know, there was a good year or two before anyone got a colonoscopy. Cancer screening in this community. And, you know, it's difficult to calculate the effect on that, but there's got to be an effect. So, you know, our legit lockdown of the hospitals in terms of saying no elective procedures at all, that ended a few weeks ago. Right. So hospitals are scheduling procedures, you know, ambulatory surgical centers are doing the same. I think that there's messaging that we need to do a better job of in letting folks in the community know, number one, the importance of having these things done. You know, don't put off stuff. It's time to get it done now. And also that, you know, hospitals and clinics are safe. They're following some good mitigation procedures. People are wearing masks. They're checking people's symptoms. In a lot of cases, they're actually conducting COVID tests prior to a surgery or another procedure. So, I mean, folks, you know, it's reasonable to think people are afraid of coming into a hospital or a clinic now, but there are some good safety measures in place, and it's a safe thing to do. And at this point, I wouldn't put anything off if it was me or my family.
Have we reached a safe harbor relative to PPE for our healthcare providers and institutions?
Well, better. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, when you're in safe harbor, it means you can go to sleep on the deck. I don't think we're there yet, but we're in a much better place. Nurses and docs on the front line are not having to reuse certain items the way that they did. For example, these blue plastic disposable gowns that are really intended to be single-use disposable. We were literally disinfecting them and reusing them multiple times when we were in the throes of this. We're not doing that anymore. And as a requirement for a clinic, a surgery center, or a hospital to perform non-emergency procedures now, we're asking them to keep a minimum of 5 days worth of PPE on hand, and facilities are doing that. So that goes to show that we're in a better place, but I wouldn't say we're 100% out of the woods.
Is it still a supply chain issue?
Yeah, it's still a supply chain issue. The private market did a good job of ramping up production. You know, at first, all of these chains went through China, and that was hard to deal with. It was also just a supply and demand, and we were competing on the private market with other states, other hospital systems, even the Fed sometimes. All of that has gotten significantly better. So there's PPE coming in. Some of it comes in through FEMA, and some of it comes in through the private market.
Absolutely. Dr. Cantor, I once again can't thank you enough. I mean, I think we put a lot of relevant, valuable data out there today, and we really appreciate you being so forthright in your answers, as we always do, and I know the listening audience appreciates it as well. You have a great Memorial Day weekend. Try to get some rest, Doc.
Thanks, Neil. You too, and thank you for asking really good questions. I appreciate it.
All righty. We'll be right back after the break. 260-1870 or text 870-870. This is Newell on WWE.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.